Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who may not be with you corporeally, but we are enjoying ourselves immensely. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And it's time to wrap up this trial with the final segment known as The Ultimate Foe. It's been a long, long 14 weeks to get to this point, or 572 weeks, depending on how you look at it. Yeah, so we have this two-parter, which was shot third. It was shot before Terror of the Vervoids. These six episodes were shot as a six-parter, which is why we get all this lovely location work in the Industrial Museum with all those lovely buildings and pride in every cog and piston. So this is Bonnie Langford's first work on the show chronologically, and also, as we know, Robert Holmes' last work on the show, as he passed away while writing the final episode. Yeah, so that's pretty much the background of this one.
I think it is a giant mess, and I think it exhibits all of the problems that we've talked about with the trial before, that they didn't go into it with any coherent plan about what was going on or how the bits of evidence fitted together. And so at the end, it just becomes kind of clear that no one is on the same page. And the whole thing is just massively exacerbated by Holmes's death. He doesn't finish episode 14. He writes episode 13, which I think is probably the best single episode of the trial. He doesn't get to write episode 14. Saywood writes a script for episode 14, but then has a giant dummy spit and walks, taking it with him. And who else do we get in to do a sort of a sudden patch-up job at very short notice with very short turnaround time than Pip and Jane Baker?
Question about episode 13. I thought Bob did a pass of it and he was ill, and I thought Popplewick was actually Eric Saywood's creation.
That's quite possible, because Eric Saywood does massively rewrite the script from the moment the Doctor enters the Matrix. So the plot, if you like, is Robert Holmes, and some of the dialogue might be, but from various reports, it looks like from halfway through the episode, it's 90% Eric Saywood, and Robert Holmes' name ends up on it for two reasons. One, it was still frowned upon at the BBC for script editors to commission themselves. And also, Eric had such deep respect for Robert Holmes and took the attitude that if he could have finished writing it, he would have done. The reason that Eric's part 14 doesn't end up going on screen is the reason that Eric left the show and gave that explosive interview in Starburst where he called everyone horrible. And that is, in the initial conception of the season, spoiler alert, the Valyard is a future incarnation of the Doctor, or as he ends up being, a distillation of the Doctor's evil impulses, somewhere between his 12th and final incarnation. But in the initial thought, which was agreed to by Eric, by John, and by Robert Holmes, the Doctor and the Valyard were going to end up in a sort of Reichenbach-Fall situation where they fall into something, and there's a season cliffhanger as to whether the Doctor gets out or not. Now, it's never been confirmed, but it's been suggested that part of the reason for that is JNT knew that this was meant to be his final year again. And he also knew that once he left, people could make whatever changes to the show they wanted. So in JNT's mind, at that stage, when they were first scripting everything, if they decided they wanted to get rid of everyone, including Colin, you can have a regeneration off-screen and do that. During the development of the season, JNT realised that you were going to have 13 weeks of cliffhangers followed by another cliffhanger, and thought, well, that's not very fair to the audience.
You know, originally when I'd heard rumours of what Sayward's initial script for episode 14 was like, I thought that, you know, a giant cliffhanger like that at the end would have been terribly exciting. But now I think it would have been a terrible mistake. I think you've put us through all this nonsense for 14 weeks and you're going to leave us there like that. It's just not really good enough. And it's sort of Sayward drama. Do you know what I mean? Oh, we'll kill the companion. Oh, you know, we're going to be very gritty. The doctor's going to be off his face on Voxnik. You know, we're real grown-ups here. But in fact, it is a sort of cheap and sort of rather dismal end to something that's been going on for a long time. And I think the audience probably deserves something better than that.
Agreed. The audience deserves answers, you know, and it deserves a proper conclusion. But the problem is, as we've discussed, the trial was never really set up properly anyway to resemble a real trial. And I think another problem is the fact that they give themselves just two episodes to do it in. And when you watch that big expose on the DVD for the last episodes of Trial about the whole making of it, he goes into the fact, like, the first story is not actually supposed to be a trial. It's, you know,
an inquiry.
You know, I really think that should have been three episodes and then four episodes with Perry's death in the middle. Four episodes, and then give us three episodes at the end of actual, you know, time to actually process everything and give us answers and actual danger. Like, you know, we haven't had real danger, and this is why I think I like this episode the best out of all the season. Like, the fact that suddenly the Doctor is put into danger and is not in a box in a room commenting on
the TV.
You know, I look back and I can't give it to a single Pip and Jane Baker episode. I have problems with the first story, you know, with all the terrible puns on Nakajad and all that sort of stuff. And I think episode 4 and episode 5 have the worst bits of that in it.
Yeah.
Then you've got the two episodes in Middle of Mind where the Doctor, is he or isn't he? And I think that's a problem. And then you've got all the last episode of Mind Warp where all the dialogue for the Inquisitor should really be the Valyard. So I think by default, this episode, because it gives us some answers, right, to a degree, and there's real danger happening, ends up, I think, probably been the best written. And then this whole concept about the Valyard being this distillation between the 12th and final incarnation of the Doctor, like, I mean, well, how did that come about? Did the Time Lords create him because he found out about Ravelox, or was it some sort of future experiment that's gone wrong with the Master? You know, there's no answer.
I actually don't mind that so much. I think, you know, we've kind of seen things like Choji and the Watcher and stuff who are kind of adjuncts to a Time Lord around about the time of their regeneration. And we can kind of sort of squint and see that maybe the Valyard's the same thing. And I think any kind of real explanation would be a little bit leaden. I don't think it's any coincidence that the Valyard hasn't found his way into Doctor Who mythology, really. He does get a throwaway reference in a Matt Smith episode, I think.
Yes, in The Name of the Doctor.
Yeah, so he does get referenced there. But, you know, the New Adventures deliberately went out of their way to avoid him as a kind of, as a bit of a mess. He doesn't really make his way into our mythology, and I think because he is sort of slightly half-baked. I think the thing that makes the Valyard good is Michael Jayston's performance, but he's not, he's like the Master. I think the Master's a kind of terrible character that's only saved by some of the actor's performances. But essentially, he's just, or she is just, someone who's evil for no particular reason. And the same with the Valyard. I think, in fact, it's not where the Valyard comes from sort of metaphysically, but why the Doctor's evil impulses are kind of lawful evil, as it were.
Yeah. He's not a maniac, and he's been sitting around for the last 12 weeks going, I'm going to go through this charade of a trial. You know, he's not insane.
No. And the Doctor is someone who rebels against bureaucracy and laws and strictures, and that's a particularly Holmesian conception of what the Doctor's about. Whereas the Valyard's quite the opposite of that. It's not just that the Valyard's evil, but the Valyard is interested in procedure and rules and laws and all of those kinds of things. So he's the Doctor's opposite, but, you know, like what the Doctor secretly fantasizes about, filling in lots of forms and stuff. You know, is that what we're to understand? It doesn't really make any sense.
And it's not helped by the fact that we have a change of writers, and Pip and Jane Baker have to write that script in 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And so they put their own take on it. So he goes from wanting the future incarnations to suddenly, you know, wanting to destroy all the Time Lords in the trial room, which is going to cause the downfall of the High Council. Like, it makes no real sense. Like, have Gallifrey all been watching this trial from the beginning? It seems to indicate that when insurrectionists are running amok on Gallifrey, they could only have been watching this trial because, you know, the High Council are corrupt and the Doctor is a champion of the people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it's terrible word peril as well. I mean, nothing could be less interesting than insurrectionists running amok on Gallifrey, I think. But we don't even see that. You know, it is just something that's said by someone to up the stakes, and it really muddies the water of what the trial's about. In fact, I think it's a perfect metaphor for the trial. No one making the show had any idea what the trial was about, and so bringing Pip and Jane in at the last minute to kind of wreck it kind of works on some level.
Yeah, there's even a line early on from the Inquisitor in one of the earlier stories where she says that this is a secret tribunal, and yet everyone on Gallifrey seems to have been watching it sitting in Zorak's box on their laptops, you know what I mean? Something I do love about this particular episode, you know, so we've had Doctor Who basically adopt this new structure, and it's not even terribly good. It's three people sitting in a room commentating on the action. So what they do in episode 13 is the Master turns up and breaks the show, which is what the Master is meant to do. That line, you know, where the Inquisitor says, "You have no part in these proceedings." And he says, "No, but I'm enjoying myself immensely." And he just turns up and wrecks everything, because when he comes in, he sends Glitz there to give us the exposition of what was happening in the first story and why the Doctor is on trial. And even though it's an info dump, because it's Glitz kind of just giving the information offhand because he doesn't think it's important, that makes it interesting. And then when the Master makes the big reveal that the Valyard is actually the Doctor or a distillation of the Doctor or whatever, again, it's just conversational because I don't care. You know,
what, we don't care because we don't care about this program. So are you saying like it's like they don't really care?
No, I'm saying it's really good because it kind of reestablishes the Master, because a big complaint we've had about the Ainley Master is, at his worst, he just turns up to kill the Doctor, and that's his raison d'etre. Whereas here, he's seen the Doctor is in trouble, and he's just like, oh, while he's in trouble and everyone's looking that way, I can go in and plunder the Matrix. Oh, and by the way, he's your evil twin, didn't you know? Anyway, I'm off.
Yeah, it is a throwaway line, isn't it?
It's a throwaway line, and it helps to establish that he's got his own stuff going on. It's not just about you, Colin.
I think that's a good take. Like, I mean, when I watched it as a kid, like, it's just this throwaway line. I'm going, what? That's how you're going to reveal this, you know? And now I think it does work in that way.
Yeah, well, I think how it kind of works is that the Master's turned up and he takes control of the show for a bit. And then after that reveal, Colin stands up and he's just incredibly still. And he repeats the information, and we're back on him now.
Yeah.
So that episode, there's kind of a bit of a tussle for control of the show, but it works.
I think Colin's really good when he learns that the Valyard's him. That revelation should halt this trial immediately. Mm. I really like that line, and I think that's quite tense for an episode that has mostly been people standing around and talking.
Mm. And, of course, the Valyard gets away because the guards are just standing there doing nothing.
Yeah.
See, that's one of the things I kind of think, you know, I've commented about the black studio floor before. And I used to think it was, like, supposed to be, like, a big abyss or something like that. But instead it's like, oh, no, we're just going to have you run across the front of the camera and then around the back, you know,
really
the
bad
limitations of this trial room. But, of course, you know, Anthony's also under contract to do his appearance for the season, so they have to work him in somewhere.
Well, they could just pay him and not have him appear. They do that sometimes.
Well, they did that for Colin and Nicola last year.
Well, that's it.
You know, Colin got paid for a whole extra season.
So we do get two witnesses, right? We get Sabalon Glitz. And I do love it when they're in the Matrix and that spear comes out of nowhere and just goes straight into his stomach. I always laugh my head off at that. But it is, again, a rewriting of the whole Matrix concept that you can physically go into the Matrix.
But in a sense, I don't care very much about that. I actually think it's better to have them go through a door than it is to have them lie down on a bench and strap a big thing to their head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's boring. So that never really worried me. I think that this version of the Matrix is obviously vastly less interesting than the one we got. in episode 3 of The Deadly Assassin, which was really tense and sort of terribly interesting. This is a lot of running around and a lot of sort of fake out peril and things that make no sense, but not in a sort of weird kind of fabulously surreal kind of way. It's kind of like poison gas and quicksand and, you know, the whole thing kind of just falls to pieces. And that's why I'm not sorry that we only have 2 episodes of it, because once we leave the trial and everyone's just sitting around the trial room kind of watching everything else on telly, what actually happens in The Matrix isn't all that good, really.
Well, I just love the fact that the Doctor's out there and in peril and at least something's happening. At least we're not sitting there, you know?
True,
but yeah.
But I think Melanie comes off worse for wear in this one. I mean, it's her first story, but things like Melanie, known as Mel, and she goes, "That's it, Doc. Now we're getting at the dirt." Like, just lines of dialogue that just don't really add to her character.
Well, you know? They don't work because they're written by Pip and Jane Baker, you know, a lot of the time.
Or Eric Saywood.
Or Eric Saywood.
we're never sure.
And the other thing is, of course, that we said last week, the way that Mel performs it, the way that Bonnie Langford chooses to perform it at this stage is very theatrical and very big. And so she's unable to rescue those lines just by acting. And we know that she is a good actor, and we've seen her have moments of it, but her standard way of presenting herself at this stage really does the dialogue kind of no favours at all.
Yeah.
She does get very good moments, though. I actually, it's a bit too large, but I love the moment with the fake trial and her objection to that, and she sums it up really well with, "The Doctor's convinced he must sacrifice himself, and you're prepared to let him do that." I think she plays the disgust of that very well. Again, it's a bit too loud. Getting back to something you said earlier about this interior of The Matrix, I actually like it more than The Deadly Assassin because, you know, we're told that this is the Valyard's domain and he's creating it, so it is more disciplined and more structured. And I think all the stuff in the sort of Victorian steamworks is in a way critiquing the show, because the Doctor has always had this Victorian or Edwardian sensibility, and the Valyard's using that against him. Mm-hmm. He's using all this grand grignol, as the Sixth Doctor says, which the Doctor loves so much, and turning it in on itself. And he's using bureaucracy as well, which he knows the Doctor hates. I think it's actually not quite taken far enough. Yeah, especially the bit on the beach then has no connection.
No.
It's striking visually. It just has no connection.
Well, it's not that striking. It's like the world's most miserable day at the beach.
But the wind and the sort of desolation with the Valyard then popping in and out of reality, and his lines start before he pops into reality. Yeah. And it kind of breaks what you would expect to happen, which is he would appear, deliver a line of dialogue, and then have to stand very still while they line up the film and disappear. And this time, because they're working on video and they have that stability, instead of working on film, they're just like, "No, we're just going to do it this way." And there's some really good shot composition there as well, like when Glitz is suggesting insults for the Doctor and the Valyard creeps up behind him over his shoulder. Oof, microbe!
I do love that sequence. And obviously that's Pip and Jane Baker at the beginning of episode 14, but I also love it when they go through the waiting room and the Doctor says, "This is a very odd waiting room." I just love that particular line.
I like the second waiting room where I think Mel opens the door and there's a dragon.
Yeah.
It is fabulously silly and random, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, Colin and Bonnie are great together. And to Colin's great credit, when Bonnie comes into the trial room, he plays it differently than he plays it in Vervoids, because in Vervoids they've known each other for ages and they have kind of verbal shorthand together and they bounce off each other. Whereas here, he's actually really wary of her. He calls her Melanie rather than Mel because he hasn't met her yet. And when he goes into the Matrix, he takes Glitz with him. He doesn't take Mel because of Perry's death.
And he knows Glitz and doesn't know Mel.
Yeah.
But also because Mel's a girl and we just need her to stand around rather than getting involved in the action.
There's that hilarious bit, right, where the keeper trips her over and you think, "Oh, that's a bit rubbish." Yes. But that is brilliantly cut down sort of 2 scenes later where he tries to trip her over again and looks really pleased with himself, and she kicks him in the shin and nicks the key. I really love that, because you're like, that first one was crap. And she's like, "Well, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, I won't be fooled again."
I love the fact that you love all that. I think it's just so stupid. I actually sit there going, really?
We're kicking each other. Yeah. This is how we get into the Matrix.
And you know, a few minutes ago you talked about these wonderful lines that she has. Like she goes, you know, when the master goes, one must destroy the utter. And she goes, how utterly evil, how utterly over the top. And then she goes, the valiant has taken...
advantage of the Doctor's romantic nature.
And I just want to vomit at this.
I actually think that there's another, remember the Megarian who forgot to switch on his translator?
Yeah.
There's another one of those scenes, which again makes no sense, but Pip and Jane clearly think is sort of terribly clever. When it's the fake trial room and we pull back and we're in the real trial room, watching the other trial room in the trial room.
I just want to say before we go on criticising that, that's a beautiful shot.
But she says that the Doctor refuted the charge of genocide, and then later on the Doctor says, but that's how I knew it was all a simulation, because you weren't there and you wouldn't have made that mistake. Mm. And you kind of go, well, actually, she wouldn't have made that mistake. How could she have made a mistake by accidentally remembering something that she didn't see? I mean, kind of really makes no sense. And then, of course, he gets taken out in that sort of tumbrel through the Victorian streets. You'd have to think the Doctor would have twigged by then that he was in the Matrix if he's, you know, in a horse-drawn carriage somehow on Gallifrey. It's all just a bit inconsequential and all a bit of a runaround, and it doesn't really go anywhere. And the moments that try and talk about the nature of the trial don't come off. That whole sort of sleepers thing, the reveal that Glitz does in episode 13 about Ravelox and the sleepers and all of that makes just literally no sense at all. And there's no way that the Valiard would have chosen that bit as a segment of prosecution evidence if it contained all of this sort of stuff that was going to implicate the High Council. No one's motive is clear. Mm. We're running around and escaping and falling into quicksand and stuff, and it all just sort of falls to bits, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I guess it does, but I can't help but like it.
Those two things aren't in any way contradictory.
I actually really enjoy these two episodes, all the run around, the fact there's action, and I like a lot of the visuals, and you also have – like the Keeper of the Matrix, played by James Bree.
Oh, what a stupid fool he is.
Matrix, my Matrix. Please. And Popplewick, who I really love Popplewick.
Yeah, I think Popplewick seems Holmesian, but we reckon he's by Saywood, do we?
By the time the character was written, it was Saywood, but there was always that character in there.
Do you think he was always going to be revealed as the Valiard in a latex mask, though?
I think probably not. But a lot changed from sort of conception to execution, because in Robert Holmes' initial idea, the master was behind the whole trial, and Eric Saywood gave him the same advice he gave Terence Dix in The Five Doctors, where he said, well, everyone's going to expect that. So, like, in The Five Doctors, it was, no, let's have Barusa as the evil one rather than the master, and in this... Saywood's like, well, A, if as soon as the master turns up, everyone thinks he's created this when he's actually just taking advantage of it. And B, no, we've been establishing the Valiard as the villain for 12 weeks, so that's what we need to have. And I think that's a very wise decision, because as I said earlier, it gives Anthony Ainley's master the rare opportunity to actually have a life outside of wanting the Doctor dead.
We get to see Anthony Ainley's master in his TARDIS. Mm-hmm. Is that a different set, like, or is it just, like...
No, it's the same set, painted black. So...
What, they come in and they just painted the white set black?
Yeah.
And then painted back again.
And then painted back again, which is...
That's insanity.
I believe that is also what they had to do on this occasion, because this was filmed before Vervoids. And Vervoids was the first time we had seen it this season. We hadn't seen it in the previous two stories.
We also get to see in one of the worst props ever, which could have come out of a panto, which is the pirate treasure that Glitz seems to be really enamored with. It's just so rubbish.
Sort of plastic, crudely spray-painted gold.
Yes. Well, I just kind of go, oh, really?
We have learned at least that the BBC budget does run to paint, though, which is nice to know.
Although... the whole thing with the pantomime chest is the master says, will this appeal to your crass soul? He knows he's dealing with someone who likes shiny baubles. I love the master and Glitz together in this.
I mean, I think they're pretty good But again, their part of the plot involves sort of hypnotizing the Doctor and all sorts of really tiresome things that we've seen hundreds of times before.
Hmm. And then poor Pip and Jane Baker have to pull all of this stuff together, right, having not really been involved. And so we end up changing the premise where they're going to destroy all the Time Lords in the trial room, which is apparently going to cause this insurrection on Gallifrey. And the Doctor discovers a megabyte modem.
I don't even, like, what is that? Did she have one of those in her house, her modem? She was connected to the internet by a big steampunk wooden box with sort of flashing lights on it.
If you watch their interview on the
Pip and Jane,
Pip and Jane's box set, they go to great pains to say that they rang up some computer scientist people who came up with this wonderful idea for them, right? But, of course, we didn't have modems back then. So they've gone, well, we've got a thing called a modem. And then we know this term called megabyte, right? We're just going to put them together and Pip and Jane won't know the difference and, you know, there it is.
Do you remember back in the day when on the back of exercise books, on the back cover, they would have common computer terms and it would be things like COBOL and, you know, what a byte is and stuff like that.
Cylon.
I reckon someone
Boltar.
They've just picked two of those words at random and put them together. And it doesn't actually go anywhere. I mean, I guess the idea is to establish Mel as a computer scientist, although...
So she says computery things.
Computery things, that's right, but it's not that at all. And then I don't understand what's going on. Like, it does seem that something happens in the trial room and all of these sort of video effect spidery things come out to attack everyone in the trial room and we have to evacuate the trial room and then something happens back in the Matrix and then we cut back. But instead of evacuating the trial room, they've all just sort of fallen over on their desks.
Yeah, because they can't move in those collars.
Yeah, you know? Maybe that's
They're there for the day.
There's a ray phase shift. Is that?
It's triggered a ray phase shift.
Yeah. And so are those rays coming out of that thing? And so the screen's going to explode and all they can do is bow down and have their special Time Lord helmety things protect them.
Oh, maybe
and
that's, you
know,
it.
It's Gallifrey and duck and cover. That's what those are for.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But then it doesn't disseminate anyone. I mean, the Valiant just kind of falls over and stuff. And he doesn't get...
falls over and puts his hand out as if to say, ah!
Yeah, no. It's,
which is another good shot.
Yes. I agree.
Okay, how I understand that scene, and I totally get that it frustrates people even to this day. So Mel opens the cupboard and she says, it's a megabyte modem. And the Doctor comes in and says, it's a maser. I think the missing word is there, no.
No, it's a maser.
It's a maser, yeah, of course. No,
yeah,
yes.
That's the thing. She's meant to get it wrong because part of her character brief is, despite the fact she's a computer programmer, she can't work the TARDIS, so she doesn't know Gallifreyan technology. Why she would think a modem without, you know... Even if you look at a 56K modem from the 90s, the lights are not that big.
No, they look like they're from the top of a police car. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Oh, so it is a maser, which is another acronym that Pip and Jane Baker like to educate us on.
Yeah.
Well, masers were an established thing, especially in Japanese science fiction. Kaiju films, Godzilla, Gamera, had masers and were matter amplification through stimulated emission of radiation.
Yeah.
It's a laser, but instead of using light, it uses matter. I suppose in Star Trek they might call it a particle beam.
Maybe.
And yeah, it's meant to disseminate. And the Doctor realizes that the Matrix screen is the conduit. So, again, I think it's a slight attempt to be a little bit metatextual in that the television is now dangerous and the television will send rays out, which will get you, which was something horror films were doing at the time. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and The Nightmare on Elm Street in particular have a few television-related deaths in them.
You must have felt that way about the television screen towards the end of your sort of marathon live tweeting of this
That's very
story.
The thing is, like Todd, I watched these last two episodes and it's actually a wonderful romp and the energy really picks up. And if you look back on it later, you go, what's a megabyte modem? Why wasn't anyone disseminated? And I think the whole thing with the ray phase shift is actually related to black holes and singularities. When light is stretched through a black hole, that is related to a ray phase shift. So the idea is that, to quote Stephen Moffat, the megabyte modem / maser will not only explode, it will implode.
It really does look like just here's a random assortment of half-understood scientific terms, which we're going to throw at the dialogue at this point.
Yeah, I mean, episode 14 is 5 minutes over. It's almost 30 minutes long.
Yeah.
It was originally, I think, about 42. So I think a lot of the explanation is cut and it is just made a Doctor Who thing of it's going to explode and that's bad and there's going to be little squiggles. But at the same time, I can kind of watch it and go, okay, I can see what you're trying to do. I don't think you quite pull it off. But I think you don't quite pull it off in a much better way than Terminus doesn't quite pull it off with the whole, if we don't move this lever back to the start with a dog robot, then the universe will be destroyed.
Yeah, that's peak word peril right there, isn't it?
So then we get the ending where two things. First of all, Perry is living as a warrior queen with Eukarnos.
And I think we did talk about that when we did Mind Warp. I think it doesn't help. And it's just, you know, adding insult to injury at this point.
But it's also one of the reasons why Eric Saywood also left, because John Nathan Turner wanted happy endings and that was not part of the original brief.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Eric's exact words were panto walk down ending.
Why couldn't it have been something a bit different? Like she could have got back to Earth. Like, well, because we don't know, all of that stuff could have been all, you know, faked. The ending of it could have been the Doctor did actually save the day and Perry said, I've had enough, return me home.
I think it is what we said the other week. It's Andrew Hodgson's contract casino or whatever we said.
Contract roulette.
Contract roulette. That was it. It's just she happened to be with Eukarnos at the end. You know, they had a nice scene together. We decided very ill-advisedly that that was the basis for a happy or indeed acceptable marriage and we'll tinge the screen a bit pink and everything will be okay.
The novelization of Mind Warp does it much, much better. So the final chapter of the novelization ends with the courtroom actually emptying and the Doctor's just left there standing alone and utterly distraught by himself with no one to comfort him. The epilogue is then Perry is back in the States and a time storm whipped up. She's back there with Eukarnos. She doesn't know how she got back there. She doesn't know what's happened to the Doctor. She hopes he's okay, but she's his wrestling manager. She's Eukarnos' wrestling manager. And she's just had to explain to him, no, you don't actually kill people. It's just pretend. But he's very happy because people seem to be happy with it. And you know, sometimes she thinks about the Doctor. And in that ending as well, there's a hint of romance between them, but it's not really overtly stated. It's just that she's very fond of Eukarnos. And so we get our cake and we eat it as well in that ending because the Doctor doesn't know what's happened to her. So we get the emotional impact of her death. But then we find out that she's had an unconventional ending. She hasn't just been married off, which was Nicola's, like, one demand was don't marry me off. And she's happy. There's a great bit on the DVD where they record a commentary just for that reveal scene at the end with Colin and Nicola, and I think it's called A Fate Worse Than Death, i.e. being married to Brian Blessed. And Nicola all the way through is just like, yeah, they decided to do this. Oh, God, yes, okay. And Colin's laughing his head off.
And then we've got the Sixth Doctor and Mel going into the TARDIS with, of course, his last lines, carrot juice. But there's no attempt to even say, well, Mel, I need to return you home. Look, as a fan, as a continuity person, I just kind of go, look, couldn't he have returned her home? Like, because we've only got two episodes, we don't even have time to do that.
Right? But I also think it is just that they don't care. And it probably has something to do with the fact that there's this sort of hastily rewritten ending. We weren't going to have the Doctor and Mel get into the TARDIS and leave originally at the end of the trial, but now we have to do it. And any dialogue about returning her would have been kind of a bit leaden and uninteresting at the end. But there is this sense we don't get to see Mel meet the Doctor. You know, next year when she leaves him for no reason at all. Her contract's up. And so she's really kind of poorly served, I think. And her backstory makes no sense at all. Mm. Gary Russell wrote a novel called Business Unusual in which he tried to kind of write a story where they meet was in some way consistent with the kind of character outline that had been written.
The thing is, though, even the Ultimate Foe isn't consistent with the character outline that was written, because in her character outline, she meets the Doctor during a story involving the Master. And in the Ultimate Foe, she sees the Master and says, who's that?
Yeah, she's never heard of him.
And not only that, but he sent her there. So as it says in the discontinuity guide, it appears that some force has been involved. He didn't just ask her to get into the casket nicely.
Yeah.
That's it. None of it makes any sense at all. And they don't care. It's just we've got Bonnie Langford in. She's the Doctor Who girl now. Hmm. We don't really care about her as a character in a drama. It's a bit of a throwback to, you know, the late Hartnell era or, you know, the 60s where they're just sort of dumping people left, right, and centre in the middle of a story when their contract ended. Or, you know, that terrible Graham Williams thing where he kind of forgets to contract anyone except for Tom for season 17. So, you know, I think it's pretty unfortunate. And Mel suffers not only from that because we don't know what she's like as a person before she meets the Doctor. And she suffers from the fact that of her first 10 episodes, 9 of them are written by Pip and Jane Baker, who can't do dialogue. Yep. So it's unfortunate. I like her. I think she's very charming and she's got a lot of charisma as a performer. But she doesn't get to be a character really at any stage.
Yeah, the only thing that really saves Mel as a character is Bonnie Langford.
Yeah.
Because, and the strange thing is, other actors who have come into Doctor Who have approached it with reverence and not necessarily done so well. You know, I'm thinking maybe of Matthew Waterhouse, who was very reverent to the program, but was given, I would say, character material as deficient as the character material Mel is given, and yet not constructed as clear a character, because even though Mel doesn't get much character in her dialogue, you know, you look at Bonnie, and the way Bonnie plays her, she's like, right, I'm enthusiastic. I'm prone to being scared, but I recover quickly. There are distinct elements to her personality you can pull out, whereas Adric, you're like, oh, he's a bit sulky. And then you wonder, well, is he being sulky or is Matthew Waterhouse being sulky?
But, I mean, think about Adric and even think about Nyssa and Tegan, all of whom are really foregrounded in their first story. We get to them in their own world, in their own context before they join the Doctor.
Yes.
And season 18 is very, very careful about the introduction of all of those characters. And then who's the next person to be introduced? Turlough, again, you know, even though he's really sketchily out. You know, we don't know really where he comes from or anything very much about him. A lot of care is taken to introduce what kind of person he is.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true.
You know, we're recording this the day before. Can I say this?
We're
recording this the day before the pilot comes out, introducing Pearl Mackie's character, Bill. And we know from just all the pre-publicity stuff that the first episode is very largely going to be about introducing her and giving her an in into the Doctor's world. And that's the right approach, I think. Think about the first episode of Doctor Who, which is all about Barbara and Ian discovering the Doctor and ending up in his world. And we don't bother to do that anymore.
Yeah, and really there was no reason that Terror of the Vervoids couldn't have been written with Mel as the stewardess aboard the Hyperion 3.
Mm.
You know, she didn't have to be the 1980s computer programmer. If she's a stewardess aboard the Hyperion 3, 1,000 years in the future, it'd be quite understandable that she would have some computer knowledge.
Yeah, she'd know what a megabyte modem was.
Yeah, exactly. And then she stows away at the end and the Valyard could say, ah, well, you've taken another companion. The Doctor says, well, it wasn't my choice. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see she stowed away. And then she turns up in there and we have an introduction story for her. And you know what? That has never occurred to me before. I just came up with that in the last 10 seconds he was talking. As for what we get instead where he wanders off with her at the end, you know, I've thought for years, okay, the reason they haven't done a drop Mel back off with her own Doctor is, you know, they have to set up a scene and do that and blah, blah, blah. And again, I just thought, well, no, put Colin in his Vervoids costume and while the Doctor is talking to the Inquisitor in the courtroom, another Sixth Doctor pokes his head around the door in the Vervoids outfit and says, oh, Mel, I've been looking everywhere for you. Come on. And as she runs out, the Inquisitor's just like, what? Well, she is from my future, you know. Time for me to be off. And the other Colin leaves as well, and you get, like, maybe two TARDISes next to each other disappearing at the same time. And that, I think, gets the idea across without having to set up this whole scene and without having to have the leaden dialogue of, come along, Mel, and with the resources they have. They don't have to hire any other actors or build any extra sets.
We'd have had to see that Vervoid tie again, though.
Oh, no, don't want to go back there. And then we get the very typical Pip and Jane Baker ending, where they like to end on some sort of cliffhanger note, right? Where, of course, you know, everything's wrapped up. The Inquisitor, I think, is going to take charge of Gallifrey or whatever she's going to do. And I really do love Linda Bellingham in these two episodes. It's nice to see her actually walk into the out of the trial room and then back into the trial room, yes, rather than just sitting behind her at a desk. Poor love. And then we get the final sequence of the Keeper and him turning to the camera to reveal
he was the Valiard all along.
Do you think he was the Valiard all along? I always thought he came out on one of those squiggly line things. Because as he collapses, you see one go into his face and fly out of his face.
So you reckon he just smacked James Bree on the head, you know, and took his clothes? Maybe there's a naked James Bree trussed up in a cupboard somewhere on that space station.
Don't tell Richard Franklin.
Maybe now. Maybe even now.
I don't know what to say after that. Look, the Master alludes to that the Valiard's got control of the Matrix, so why can't he then be like the Keeper of the Matrix? Like, I'm thinking back to the Pirate Planet, you know, you have like that old queen and then her young nurse projection, like that sort of thing. That's how I've always thought of it, like a projection of him, but with just with a different face. And then when it comes to it, you know, he has escaped because he's in control of the Matrix and he's from the Matrix. And I do think that Michael Jason does a great James Bree voice, you know, because when he goes, "Yes, my lady," I actually thought it was like,
James Bree. You think there's something odd about his voice, but you don't immediately think it's Michael Jason. And Todd, I think you might be onto something there, because the Keeper is constantly denying the possibility that anyone's broken into the Matrix, and he's constantly denying the possibility that someone can be based in the Matrix. And when it happens, he just goes, "Oh, I'm terribly surprised about that." Yeah, maybe you're right, Todd. Maybe he's not the stumbling buffoon he appears, but he's just another Popplewick-style servant of the Valiard.
Maybe.
I think it's a cute ending.
I do like it. Like, it's great that, you know, throughout the trial, we've had so many zooms on the doctor's face, you know, constantly. And in episode 13, you know, you've got the "no" when he's going to the
set. Oh, I hate.
But here.
Sorry, go on.
But it still ends on the doctor's face.
Yes.
It's just a different face.
It's brilliant. The reason I hate that "no"
is Colin's fat tongue.
Well, no, that's fine. Colin sells the danger well in that moment, but you're just like, "Oh, for goodness sake, fortify yourself, man. You've had a train barreling down on you in the Matrix and you didn't scream, 'No!' You're just sinking, for God's sake, and you know, you've distributed your weight. Don't struggle. Certainly don't wiggle your butt into it the way you do. You're not going to sink if you remain calm. If you just stand there screaming, that's when your spats get covered in mud."
It's a mess, that scene. It's really poorly realised.
I think it's poorly directed.
Yeah.
Like, because poor Colin has to collapse down, and then you see him actually move one of those hands to grab his side. Much like that creature in Mind Warp where, you know, where he has to move his hand to make it obvious with the gun,
with the
Urak or whatever.
Yeah,
it's the same sort of thing where it's like it's the direction letting down what has to happen.
Yeah.
So ratings-wise with this, 4.4 million viewers tuned in to episode 13. And then 5.6 million for the final episode coming 80th. So the highest rating of the season is the last. And it's the only time that the show preceding Doctor Who, Roland Rattle, whatever it was actually in the top 100, right? So the only time it gives it a bit of a boost. But it is interesting that, you know, that I think there is viewer fatigue after 12, 13 weeks, that you suddenly go from 5.2 or 5.3 at the end of Vervoids, then there is like literally almost a million viewers less. How are we promoting this? The final two episodes of the trial, that people are going, "Well, we've still got another week. We can tune in next week, I guess, to see." And it's back to the whole argument that this whole concept of having one story just doesn't lend itself to having
new people come in during the season.
New people come in. Yeah. And the way I described it is that I think the ratings are soft, right? Mm. There's some episodes that are higher than five, but then you'll get one that does dip down to the mid-fours. You can't just draw a line of best fit to say that the audience is actually increasing week to week.
Yeah.
The overall rating for the season is 4.8 million, right? Which is 2.2 million down from last season. Like next year, we're going back to what, you know, they said they're going to go do a traditional format this year. Next year, they're going back to individual stories.
Yeah.
And what you get is you get 5.1 coming in to see the new doctor. Then there is a drop to 4.2, 4.3. And episode one of
Paradise Towers
gets 4.5. But episode two gets 5.2.
Right.
So people are going into work and school and talking about it.
And then in Delta and Bannum, 5.3 for episode one. For Dragonfire, 5.5. Yeah. And all the episodes from that 5.2 onwards are above 5 million, except for the last episode of the season. If you draw a line of best fit, you can actually see this gradual increase.
Right.
It's a new story. You can tune into a new story. Yeah. It's not this, oh, it's still going on business.
Yeah.
A big problem I have with this story, and you've both just touched on it now, it feels very enclosed and private and claustrophobic. You know, we do have guest cast, but two of the three guest cast, the Master and Glitz, are characters we've seen before, and Popplewick is a cipher. He's not really a character for plot reasons. Whereas the previous three stories, there has really been an attempt, and I would argue some success, in creating distinct identifiable worlds which these characters live in. You know, we praised, for instance, the characterization of Katrika and Humker and Tandril and even Merdine. You know, these were people we believed in. In Mind Warp, we spoke about Madame Catrona and Crozier and Frax, and how each time we watch it, we kind of come away with a bit more appreciation.
And Syl's in that.
Syl, yeah, of course. And Lord Kiv as well, you know, dead, worse than that, poor. In Vervoids, you know, it's a mystery story, so we have to have people with readily identifiable character traits, like the belligerent one and the mad one and the mercantile one and what have you. But still, they're really well performed. And, you know, the Commodore and Lasky and Bruckner and Kimber, you know, they're memorable, they're memorable characters.
Yeah.
We come to this, and certainly there are memorable visuals, but it just feels, it feels so insular. It's the same problem I had with Hellbent, which I really enjoyed, but because, you know, we're on Gallifrey and all the characters we meet, people we've met before, you lose a bit of interest. I still enjoy it, and I don't really fault it on that, but it's just like, this doesn't feel as much fun as the other ones because I'm not learning anything new.
And I guess we're split between a room that we're already thoroughly sick of and a location that isn't real.
Yeah.
So there's something inconsequential about it. And if it had been a venue for all sorts of really thrilling political intrigue based on the trial, which is clearly what they're attempting to do but failing to do, then perhaps they could have pulled it off. But as it is, it's just a sort of fairly standard bunch of running around and being hypnotized and having harpoons shot at you and stuff, but nothing, nothing really actually happening. And so I think it does fall to bits.
Yeah.
But, you know, overall, I really enjoy this. I enjoy it. Like, I mean, I give this 8 out of 10. Like, I mean, and that sounds insane despite, despite, you know, all these problems with the script and what it's doing and all this sort of stuff. I can sit there and I feel like at the end there's a weight being lifted from this trial thing that's sitting there, and, you know, we are getting resolutions, I guess, you know, and we're not just sitting in a trial room for the two episodes. But, you know, I've just given it 8 out of 10, so I kind of, you know, have made it my favourite story. But but it's not really, like, it gets it because it's wrapping up everything else before it. I don't know if I'm making much sense there.
No.
And in the end, for me, for the trial still comes back to being 7 out of 10. Like, even if my scores are above that, but the lightness that Colin brings into the role this year is something that I think that you, Nathan, have pointed out. And there's just lots of things that I've really enjoyed within the stories, but then all this sort of trial stuff that's crap.
With some exceptions, I like the tone of this better than I like the tone of season 22. I think that they have learned some things, but I also think that we're still in a show where all these tunnels look the same to me. And
more so because Eric Sayward really doesn't know what he wants.
Yeah.
Or John Nathan Turner, really, either of them.
Yeah. No. I do think that had John Nathan Turner had a different script editor, or had Eric Sayward had a different producer, in either situation, they each would have produced better work. As much as I do believe the failings of the last 5 years of Doctor Who can mostly be ascribed to Eric Sayward, I am not going to say that JNT is without fault for these flaws.
I think it's something that we can discuss perhaps in the retrospective, because I've come to the same conclusion. We've lampooned Eric Sayward, but there's underlying decisions that are made that have put him in this situation, yeah. and they come from J&T and other people in the BBC. Mm.
I have to agree with your scoring, though, Todd. I actually give this two-parters 9 out of 10, and the whole trial I give a 7 out of 10. I enjoy this in the same way you can enjoy Earthshock, in that, you know what, it's great fun and it's fantastic. Just don't try and think about it too hard. But there's two other cool bits that I have forgotten to mention earlier. I'm looking back over my tweets from our hashtag FTE trial marathon. I will be doing this again for season 24, all in one day. There's the bit where the master mentions summary execution. And the rhubarb of the Time Lords sitting around is they all turn to each other and whisper, summary execution. And there's also the bit where Glitz is holding Popplewick at gunpoint and the Doctor and Mel are having a conversation and walk between them. And at first you might think, strategically wise, that's a really terrible move. It's like, no, these two are bloody cooler than you. Shut up.
It's a nice shot.
It's a very nice shot. You know, I love these two together. I wish we'd gotten another year of them together, Colin and Bonnie. I think they get the chemistry so right, including in this. There's that great scene where she runs up to him and has that horrible line, you're not signing on as a martyr yet. But it's kind of like opera. Don't listen to the words, listen to the emotion, and listen to them arguing the next second, like the Doctor saying, I knew what was going on. You're never feeling the tension that you feel between Colin and Nicola as the Doctor and Perry. It is that kind of playful arguing, sibling arguing that they were trying to go for. And I don't think it's the fault of the actors that it didn't work before. I think the emphasis was wrong, and I think the emphasis has changed now, and Colin and Bonnie play that perfectly. And they're so visually striking together because he's huge and she's tiny. And I haven't even mentioned a fabulous outfit in this. All that blue wispy stuff and the blue high-heeled boots, the patent leather boots. She looks amazing.
You know, we used to complain about Nicola's character not dressing like a student.
Yes.
Whereas Mel really dresses like someone in a crappy light entertainment science fiction show, doesn't she really?
I hate her hair in this, actually.
Yeah, awful, awful.
I think it's it's certainly my least favourite of all of her hair. Why I'm concentrating on that. I'm still laughing about don't go through that door. Every time I watch that, that just cracks me up when she opens that and it has to be that fake dinosaur going, rah!
Todd, shall we reenact it now? You be Colin, I'll be Bonnie.
Don't go through that door. It's such love that, you know? Oh, I'm going to give this 9. And the season still gets a 7. When what was needed was a 9, but, you know.
So what's your score out of 10?
I don't give scores.
You don't give scores. You just give us.
Yeah, it's tiresome.
Right, speaking of tiresome things, it's time for Jenny Laird Awards for most puzzling creative choice.
So I have one.
Uh-huh.
I was speaking last night on chat to Stephen Buzanowski.
Friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast. And I think we agreed that there's a creative choice here which is not only puzzling but actually catastrophic, and I think it is the decision to kill Perry at the end of Mind Warp. And in Mind Warp, we said that we thought it was technically well done and that the whole kind of ominous, doom-laden atmosphere of episode 4 of Mind Warp was really masterful. But killing a companion's a bad idea, I think, generally. I think you just get away with killing Adric because, you know, he's a jerk, but also because he's part of an ensemble as well. Mm. But when you have the single character who we've been traveling with for a long time, who the Doctor kind of sacrificed his life for, who is supposed to be, you know, an audience identification figure, I think that it comes from a place of a complete misunderstanding of what Doctor Who is, what its tone should be, what its audience is, what it's for, why it's lasted all this time. You know, I think you can kill Tasha Yar in season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation, but you can't kill one of two regular characters. And doing it in such a horrific way, a way where her body is taken over by a creepy old man, a way that just utterly reflects the way that she's been manhandled and mistreated and drooled over and lusted at and sexualized for her entire time on the show. I think it's awful and probably one of the worst things ever to happen in the run of classic Doctor Who. The only comparable thing that I can think of that is just as appalling, just as terrible, you know, something that should never, ever have made it to screen is Amy Pond's baby turning into a big pile of sick in A Good Man Goes to War. I think that's horrific and indefensible. And I think that this is similar. It should never have happened. It's Sayward trying to be edgy and adult and failing and simply being cynical and nasty. And it's my puzzling creative choice for the entire run of the classic series.
Wow.
Yeah.
My creative puzzling choice is the trial. Mm. It is the fact that Eric thought it was a good idea. John was sold on the idea. The powers that be up above let it pass, but they're not supporting the show.
Yeah, they stopped caring.
They'd stopped caring. Like, they want it gone. So, oh, yes, go ahead with this. But the fact that they took it to the table, Colin expressed concern, and you're not going to listen to your leading man. The whole concept of the trial is just my creative puzzling choice.
My puzzling creative choice. When Colin was going around during production for Mindwarp asking, am I really bad here or am I pretending or is the Matrix lying? What's actually happening here? My puzzling creative choice there, I can forgive Ron Jones for not knowing the answer. Directors of Doctor Who aren't there to change the story as they might in a Hollywood film or in any film. I can forgive Eric Saywood for not knowing. You know, the job of a script editor at this stage is not to impart meaning. The job is to make sure the script is workable and can be filmed. My puzzling creative choice is why Philip Martin couldn't answer that question.
I actually think you're letting people off the hook because I think the script is pretty clear on what's happening. That, you know, he's initially zonked by the cliffhanger to episode one, but essentially what he eventually decides is the case that the emphasis is being changed, and the bit where he torments Perry on the rock is not what happened. Like, I think that's clear from the script, and I think it's Colin's job to read the script and understand it. It's Eric's job to read the script and understand it. And for God's sake, it's the director's job to read the script and understand it so he can put it on screen. I think they're all culpable. It is fairly clear what's meant to be happening.
Yeah, but I think the buck stops with Philip Martin because Colin asked Ron, who said, I don't know. He asked Eric, who said, I don't know. And via Eric, he asked Philip Martin, who said, ask Eric and Ron. And at that point, I think the message from Ron was just, oh, play it how you think, darling.
Well, I think he gets it wrong. I also think, too, maybe Philip Martin's annoyed by the changes that have happened to his script because of the trial.
Look, I don't really know. I mean, in one of the interviews, Colin actually says that he asked Eric and he asked Ron, but he couldn't get in contact with
Philip. Okay.
Which is a different take than what he says at other points in time, right, like the memory cheats. So maybe he did speak to him, maybe he didn't. But ultimately, the script goes through the script editor. The script editor should be able to give some direction to the lead actor, right?
Yeah.
And Colin's struggling with this. And I agree with you that the director should also be able to an extent, work it out as well. And I think it is, this time through, I found it clearer. Sorry, we seem to be dishing your creative puzzling choice. No, that's fine. I'm fine with that because it is a problem in that story is that different scenes are played different ways and it makes it and I've struggled with it for years.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I probably agree with you both. I'm looking for one person to blame, but no, it's a team effort. You're right. It's all three of them. Okay, picks of the week. I've got two. My first pick of the week is the novel Matrix by Robert Perry and Mike Tucker. Mike Tucker, of course, who was a special effects person on the last few years of Classic Doctor Who and also new series Doctor Who. It's a Seventh Doctor novel dealing with what happens to the Valiard after the trial. It is a fan-wanky use of the concept of the Valiard, but it's also really well executed and tries to explain who and what the Valiard is without kind of going into Rassilon imprimaturs and that sort of thing. It's an enjoyable novel of its own right. The science fiction concepts are science fiction concepts. They're not just Doctor Who concepts. And it also plays with ideas of identity and memory. So it's very good. My second recommendation is the Big Finish audio, Perry and the Piskun Paradox, which attempts to reconcile what we saw happen in Mind Warp, what we heard happened in The Ultimate Foe, what we read about in the Mind Warp novelization and Bad Therapy, and tries to give us some closure on Perry's departure. It's a companion chronicle, so it's mostly Nicola Bryant, but the special guest voice in it is Colin Baker. I won't spoil it too much, but the ending I found particularly emotionally affecting. Actually, the ending of both halves, because it's kind of like two connected two-parters. And especially the ending of the first half, as narrated, not only narrated by Nicola, but as told by Perry. And you find out in the second half, there's one important piece of information that Perry doesn't have when she's narrating that first half that really makes it resonate even more. So Perry and the Piskun Paradox, written by Nev Fountain.
I think last season I recommended that people read Evelyn Waugh's The Loved One, which, if you haven't read it, you really should. It's truly tremendous. The BBC has just come out with a three-part adaptation of Evelyn Waugh's first novel, Decline and Fall, written in 1928. And I've seen the first two episodes to date, and it's really, really terrifically funny.
Have you seen or heard the first two episodes? Did you say it was...
No, it's a TV show.
Oh, I beg
it's terrific.
Pardon.
It stars Jack Whitehall as Paul Pennyfeather.
Oh, I love Jack Whitehall.
It has the late Tim Pigott-Smith in what must be one of his last roles, because he only just died sort of fairly recently as we record. And he's in the opening scene and he's really sort of terrifically funny. It's brutal and horrible, like all of Evelyn Waugh's stuff. He's gleefully cruel to all of his characters. And it also features a fantastic star turn from the wonderful Eva Longoria, who you might remember from Desperate Housewives. And she's super, super glamorous in it. It's laugh out loud funny. I've really, really been enjoying it. And so if you want a break from cardboard sets and mazes and megabyte modems, there's no robots in this. There's no pteroleptals in it, even though it is set in 1928. It is really, really terrifically funny, and I can recommend it wholeheartedly.
I've got no idea what I'm going to recommend. I recommend Beauty and the Beast. It's a wonderful movie about a plucky American girl and her wrestler warlord. no, we won't go with that.
It's a pretty good recommendation, though. It's even got a gay in it, like James Brie.
I'd recommend the new CW show Riverdale, because I think that's full of... nice young things and lots of angst.
Everyone's very attractive.
I'd recommend any Big Finish audio with Bonnie Langford and Colin Baker in it, because I really do think they are that well written for that pair. If I had to pick one, I'm not going to pick one of those. I'm going to pick the Wirren Isle.
Oh, yes.
Which is the Sixth Doctor with the Wirren and his companion, Flip, and I really enjoy that one. And so, yeah, just for something different, one of the Sixth Doctor's alternative companions, and I think it's a really good story.
It also uses the Wirren in an unexpected way.
Yes.
I found that. Mm. Yeah. That's by William Gallagher, who's written some very good Big Finish. Dear listener, we're not quite finished with the Colin Baker era yet. Do come back next week for a very special episode, and the week after that we'll be having our Big Finish special, so you still have time to listen to The One Doctor, Doctor Who and the Pirates, Jubilee, and The Brink of Death from the Doctor Who The Last Adventure box set. All of those are available from bigfinish.com. Don't forget, you can vote in our Tom Baker commentary, and the four options are The Hand of Fear, The Sunmakers, The Stones of Blood, and The Horns of Nymon. You can find a link to the poll in the show notes, and also at flightthroughentirety.sexy. Over on Bondfinger, we have recently said goodbye to Timothy Dalton after only just having said hello to him in License to Kill. And we also have commentaries for all the Roger Moore films and Sean Connery films. And unlike that lawsuit, because there's a lawsuit at the moment because the 50th anniversary Bond set says it has every Bond movie, but it doesn't have Casino Royale 67 or Never Say Never Again. Well, we do, so you don't have to sue us. So there. Isn't that wonderful? Until then, you can find our websites, flightthroughentirety.sexy and bondfinger.com. Bondfinger.com as well has a secret address at the moment, and we're not going to tell you what it is, but it's a word that Nathan invented during our Living Daylights commentary. So if you type in that word.com, you will be redirected to Bondfinger. You can find us on Twitter at Bondfingercast and at FTE Podcast, and over on Facebook, just search for Flight Through Entirety, our Bondfinger, same as iTunes. Until next week, may your Matrix get a bit more maintenance than once a millennia. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brandon Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Gallifreyan Duck and Cover, was recorded on the 15th of April 2017. The next episode will be released on the 28th of May. Now that we've discussed the entire Colin Baker era on television, we'll be travelling back in time to return Todd to the 30th of December 2014, so he can record his first ever appearance on the podcast. See you soon, Todd.
And today is boobity boo of April.
15th.
15th of April.
April diggity. I'm going to turn off all of my things.
My failed hullabaloo.
Editing the episode 107 and I interrupt your thing with my watch telling me to drink water.
Okay. Oh, Todd, just hold your microphone at a bit more of an angle. I was getting breath, that's all.
We do get a bit of Todd breath from time to time.
It gives us life. Okay.
Okay, is that better?
That's better, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, I'll just remember.
Oh my God, Todd's breathing through his nose. He's angry.
Not angry.
Just said.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. I don't want to be angry. I want to be happy. Can I be happy?
Yeah.
Okay.